Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. He's got great game in every game. Spin the wheel of sports. Where do you want to go? Arash Madani fills in for Bob McCowan on Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
It is Monday, the 26th of September, the day after one of the real tough days in all of sports. Major League Baseball, Canadian Football League, the golf world, the sporting world, losing not only a young pitcher, a young defensive back, but a real icon with the passing of Arnold Palmer. Primetime Sports continues here on the Sportsnet radio and television networks. I'm Arash Madani in for the vacationing. No, he's under the weather. He's not vacationing. Bob McCowan, we hope Bob will be back in a couple of days. John Shannon is in for Damian Cox, who's also dealing with some kind of cough and flu.
Something smells when they're both off like that.
We're continuing to talk about Arnold Palmer. We're continuing to talk about Jose Fernandez. We're going to continue to talk about the Blue Jays and the National Football League as the show goes on. Arnold Palmer passing away at the age of 87, and as we welcome in Bob Ryan from the Boston Globe. Bob, what makes the Palmer thing interesting is he was as comfortable rubbing shoulders with U.S. presidents as he was Jimmy's and Joe's on fairways and banquets all across the country. People talk about the common man. Arnold Palmer was a little of that, but he could roll with royalty too.
Yeah, he wasn't an aristocrat, even though golf in his day was widely viewed and almost universally viewed as a quote-unquote country club sport. And though he did come from a golf course background, he did not come from a rich background. His father was a golf pro, quote-unquote, and groundskeeper at a modest club in Latrobe, PA. He was a son of a working man, frankly. Although his working man father happened to be a golf teacher. And he had an everyman quality about his game. His swing was not one that you would ever want to copy. He also was famous for his recovery shots. People just took to him. They connected, and he was off the course, affable and friendly, and he had all the qualities that go into stardom, and he was a mega star. He elevated golf, and he's one of the most. You could argue. Yeah, we can argue it's the Kingdom Come who the best golfer is, and whether between Tiger and Jack. But I think the king, the influential, most influential golfer of his time was clearly Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, influential, and I think that's a big part of this whole thing. Arnold Palmer was as much an icon, a sports icon, a giant, as he was anything else. He was about branding before branding was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Bob, when you look back on athletes, when all is said and done, that people will remember Arnold. If you're putting a Mount Rushmore of recognizable figures and people who did something for their sport, Arnold Palmer is there for his.
There is no question that he took his place at the table with the elite athletes at a time when golfers did not ordinarily do that. Now, there were celebrated golfers within the golfing community. I mean, hallowed names, of course, Jones and Hagen and Nelson and Hogan and Snead, etc. And Sarrazin, okay, there's six that predated Arnold Palmer. But Arnold Palmer was the one who put golf in the general public more than anybody. And there were two people in the 50s, actually, who elevated golf and democratized golf. One was the President of the United States. Dwight Eisenhower became noted for his golfing love and became associated with Augusta National and got a lot of publicity when it was reported, however, facetiously, I don't know, that he once had a 78 at Augusta National, and of course they nicknamed a tree after him at Augusta on the 17th hole. Arnold Palmer was the other one in the 50s who democratized golf, and And it really peaked. He was already on his way because he won the Masters in 58, started his run of winning his seven majors in a six-year period. But it's the Open in 1960, guys, that did it, that really, really, really did it because of the drama of it. When he was trailing the U.S. Open was a 36-hole Sunday final. Mm-hmm. And at lunchtime, he was seven strokes behind Mike Souchak, I believe it was, and he shot a 65 in the final round and won. After driving the first hole, a 300-and-some-odd-yard first hole with Cherry Hills to set the tone for his final round. That got attention. That is when the legend was born.
Well, the other part of that too, Bob, and you and I are old enough to remember this, is that a lot of people did finally see that U.S. Open on television. And so Arnold, not only was he good, but he was in your house. And that was part of his magic, exactly, and he understood that.
Golf wasn't, obviously, in the 50s widely televised, and so that was an important juncture, you're right. And people saw him, and of course, he was a swashbuckler. There was something about him, because he was every man, because he even had the cigarette dangling from his lips at a time when unthinkable today, but that's what he did. And, lit up during the course, and people could relate to that when so much of the world was smoked. And he had the swing. You wouldn't emulate that swing. Even Jim Furyk would not want that swing, but that was Arnold's swing. And the hunched over putting stroke, and it was a flair. I guess that's the word I'm searching for. Elan, cachet, whatever. He had it. He had it, and not everybody has it. He had it to a degree that Jack never had. Jack never had it like that. Jack was a better golfer in the long run, but Jack didn't have it. They had a rivalry, of course, and they became great friends, but Arnie had that special thing. Arnold had something else, too, going for him, and he was wise enough to know this. I mean, the reason that he became this great pitchman and the great businessman who died worth an estimated $650 million was not just that he was a good golfer, but he had Mark McCormick. He had an agent who was an entrepreneurial agent that got him fixed up to do things, and Arnold was a perfect pitchman, as it turned out. But you cannot tell the Arnold Palmer legend story without including the name of Mark McCormick.
Exactly. Let me ask you this, though. Can we ever see, with everything that goes on in our world today, with different platforms, social media, cameras everywhere, can there be another Arnold Palmer?
How do you define what Tiger was? I mean, Tiger took it to another level. I mean, Arnold was his era's boat lifter, if you will, tide lifter, whatever, rising tide lifting all those boats, and obviously Tiger was in his sixth sense, so I have to say, we have to say, sure. I mean, you look at influential golfers in terms of influencing the general public, elevating the sport, putting the sport more into public consciousness and more into public dialogue than it had been previous to his arrival. You have to give Tiger credit for that, just as you have to give Arnold credit for doing it at his time. So absolutely. But right now we've got some great golfers. I think golf is in great shape myself. I'm excited. I'm excited what Rory McIlroy did yesterday. I'm excited with this crop we have right now as a guy who really enjoys golf. But I don't think that any of them are going to have the immediate or have the impact that either Palmer had in his day or that Tiger had in that wonderful period of his.
Arnold Palmer, 15 days after his 87th birthday, dying last night. In addition to his performance as a golfer, let's remember that, guys, he also developed over 200 golf courses all around the world and has raised millions of dollars for prostate cancer research. Bob, that's how our night ended. Our morning began with the news that Jose Fernandez had died in that tragic boating accident along with two of his friends. I was thinking about today the ones that really shocked you. And in my lifetime, I mean, I wasn't around when the Roberto Clemente thing happened and the Thurman Munson thing happened. But I certainly remember Len Bias. And I remember when Corey Stringer dropped in because of heat stroke at Vikings training camp. And, with the Len Bias one, you're close to that in the Boston situation.
Yeah.
It was just, the wondering of what was, what could have been. And with Fernandez, we were just getting a taste of it. What is this, the Roberto Clemente crash of our generation?
We have to put the category. You're on the category of the first time earlier, in the Reggie Lewis thing. Reggie Lewis had a longer, longer career.
Yeah.
Reggie Lewis was on his way to, we don't know how great, how many multiple All-Stars, whether he would have been on a Hall of Fame trajectory. Mm-hmm. obviously, we don't know if Fernandez was definitely on one, but I think we can safely say that it appeared that he was going to get on one. That his the universal estimation of his talent was that it was as good as anyone's, and that he was on his way to greatness at age 24. And so it's the A.E. Hausman poem, you know, to an athlete dying young. That's what we're talking here. I well remember, obviously, I did live through the bias thing. I'd actually been it was personal for so many of us for so many reasons, and mine was that I had interviewed him as part of a radio team on a show just like yours in Boston in 19 the night before when he flew up the draft in those days was at noontime, and he flew up to Boston from D.C. after the draft and was up there in time to be introduced to the media and to take part in the media scrums, and I interviewed him with people a couple of other fellow colleagues on. And I can still see him in a gray suit with a Celtics hat on, and his father standing behind him, beaming. And you know, it was just so stunning. Then in my case, I was going to work the next day. I was going to the office, and my son, who was then 15, came running out of the house. Dad, Len Bias is dead. This is 9:20 in the morning. So, you know, what? You know, how would you? Oh my God! You know, so. Yeah, that was a Len Bias thing. I lived through, you know, as a fan and a writer, I lived through Thurman Munson.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was stunning. And, of course, Clemente happened in New Year's Eve in the offseason. So I there's two categories here. You know, Ken Hubbs is a good example. That's the one people remember. He was the rookie of the year with the Cubs, and he died in a plane crash in that following offseason. That's kind of more under the category of Jose Fernandez.
Bob Ryan is with us from the Boston Globe.
You know, Bob, the one thing that I saw yesterday was clubhouse after clubhouse in Major League Baseball. I mean, absolutely annihilated emotionally because of the Fernandez situation. And it got me thinking that, and you've been around as more athletes than Arash and I have ever been, there's always that ability that they think they're invulnerable. And maybe this just gets too close for them, and the effect of that they are actually human beings has a little bit of an effect on them.
I think there's something to that about the fact that the athletes who are young men, for the most part, by all our standards, feel invincible and invulnerable. Absolutely, there's a couple of things that went on here, I guess. When they heard how it happened, I cannot believe that their feeling wasn't the same as my feeling. Was this, oh, what a, I mean, yeah, you don't, any way he had died would have been awful. But this is a, I don't want to use, you know, it's on a very, 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 you know, unfortunate and tragic way to die that it seemed like it was avoidable. I'll use that word. It was an avoidable death. This wasn't an illness. This wasn't, you know, that which has been totally different circumstance. This wasn't even an accident where, you know, the car was sideswiped a la David Halberstam, who, you know, subside. He was 73 years old, but you know, he was killed en route to an interview for a book when a guy ran a red light and smashed into the car he was in. And
yeah, Nick Aiden, Heart of the Angels, also ran into that.
This
in 09.
Was an avoidable thing. Never should have happened. You know, we're going to always be left with that. And on top of the idea that he is gone and that's it, and no matter how he's gone, can't bring him back. But this was avoidable. I can't believe that doesn't resonate, too. Now, you mentioned the Universal Clubhouse reaction. Two things going on here, I think. One is, there wasn't a person in baseball unaware of his talent and not aware that he was on perhaps that Hall of Fame trajectory. And secondly, given that 25% of Major League Baseball is comprised of people for whom English is the second language and Spanish is the first, and there's probably a 95% solidarity, no matter what country they're talking about, over and above maybe an occasional individual hostility that may exist between two of them, those Spanish-speaking players feel a bond, an unspoken bond, mm-hmm. and one of their own, and one of their treasures has died. I think that really hit hard.
There's a great Dan Le Batard feature from the Miami Herald in 2013. It was published on the day that Jose Fernandez was making his All-Star Game debut, interviewing his grandmother, his biggest fan.
His abuela.
And just how much... how important it was to Fernandez to perform for her, and how much she was looking forward to his grandmother getting a chance to watch him pitch.
And then, of course, throw in the fact that, you know, he leaves a pregnant pregnant mother to be behind.
Right.
And it's just unspeakably tragic. It's just awful on every level, and it made far worse by the fact that, sadly and just frustratingly, this obviously was an avoidable death.
Bob, we appreciate the time. Difficult topics to discuss, but terrible day.
Next week, we'll have some nice playoff talk to toss around.
And there you go. And maybe by then the Patriots won't even need a quarterback and they'll be 4-0.
Bob might be playing quarterback.
And there you go. The more you can do, Ryan. All right, Bob Ryan joins us. Thanks so much for that. Just a crummy day.
It was Sunday was a hard day. It was a hard day from beginning to end.
The World Cup of Hockey continues. We know who will be playing for the title. Canada, of course, and now Team Europe is through, knocking off Sweden, but it appears that Team Europe is going to be a little undermanned. Peter Bondra is now a scout with Team Europe, and not good health news today, Mr. Bondra, huh?
No, we didn't have a good news, but that's just part of the game, and we have to fill up the hole for Gabby.
Yeah, that bad news is that Marion Gaborik's out with a lower body injury. The LA Kings have already announced from their perspective that they believe he's out at least 12 weeks with a foot injury. So Peter, your discussions, you and Miro Chetan and the crew, how do you who's going to be looked at to fill the void for Marion Gaborik?
Well, the only forward we have left is Bodker, so there's no reason for us not to put him in up there unless coaches have a different strategy. But, obviously it will be hard to fill up Gabby. He was an impact player for us. He scored big goals for us. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure this is a great opportunity for a new guy to step it in and fill up the spot.
Peter Bondra joins us. Peter, what was most important to get by the Swedes?
Well, I think the patience. I think more the game when was even. I think the pressure was shifting to their side and more. And it looks like we executed playing well, game plan well, and we scored the goals in the key times. And just the way the game was played, I think it was a really bold and patient game. And we are happy to be on the happy side.
You know, the key thing, and I know this is a team that is represented by eight countries from Europe, but it must give you a little bit of pride, Peter, knowing that there's a real Slovak influence on this club when you think Jaro Halak, the goaltender, Zdeno Chara has really played a role, Marian Hossa up front. There was a lot of reasons because there was a point 10 years ago where the Slovakian team was a real factor on the international stage, and really in many ways it's still a big factor when it comes to this team.
Yes, but we don't look at it that way as a group right now. We create a group which is a little bit special group. We are a team with no past, but who knows what is our future. But same time, we look at it as the players, what country came from, and everybody's chipping in, and not just you mentioned those guys, but I can mention some other guys like Bellemer, Dreisaitl. Those guys have been there through whole tournament, and they are impact players for us. So yes, it's good to see it. Obviously, Slovakian hockey is not going directions where we like to go, but this is a different discussion. But same time, each player of our group represent their own country, and we always do take a pride as the players.
Peter Bondra joins us. He is a scout with Team Europe and the World Cup of Hockey. They will be meeting Canada for gold. It is a best 2 out of 3 format to see who will win the 2016 World Cup of Hockey. These Canadians aren't bad, huh, Peter? They're pretty loaded. They're pretty deep. What jumps off the page initially when you guys sit down in your meetings?
If I look at from upstairs, the Canadian team, anybody could be on a power play. If you put 4 line and there's nobody can even argue if those guys don't belong on the power play or on the special teams. And, this is really good team. They haven't lost the game. Definitely there's a lot of confidence in the team, and they play a fast game. They put you on the heels right off the bat. And their power play, it's insane, unbelievable. I mean, I was watching that they had a power play against us, and I was counting shots. They released 9 shots on the 1 power play. The 7 shots, Jaro Halak has to stop, and 2 we only block. So that kind of power play put definitely a lot of pressure and put the any team on the heels and a scramble. So obviously, you know, they're playing great, one of the great greatest team probably ever been assembled, if I have to say that. But at the same time, we're there for a reason. We deserve to be on the finals, mm-hmm. and we'll try to make it difficult for Team Canada.
Does Canada's speed and size force you to play a faster game than you played against Sweden?
I think so. There's definitely, I don't think it's going to be like a patient game. They will try to jump on us, and for us, the key is going to be we need to relieve ourselves from the pressure with quick passes, good chips, and with good support. And that's, we need to go in the other direction, just create some hopefully admin rushes if they go full out. So it's going to be definitely a lot of tactics. I'm not too here to discuss how we're going to perform, how we're going to play. This is coach's job. I think we'll be ready for Team Canada, and we'll try to be our best.
How well did you know Ralf Kruger before this tournament?
I worked for Team Slovakia. I was a GM for 4 years, so Ralf was coaching Swiss national team, so I was involved with those tournaments. I had a chance to talk to him early before, and you know, so he's a great coach. He's a really well-spoken coach, which is he can prepare team well for any events, and we are like really lucky to have him. Not just him, but all our other coaches and all our staff as well.
Peter Bondra joins us, a scout with Team Europe in the World Cup of Hockey. Peter, it seems the players have really enjoyed this. The fans have responded. The rating numbers have been very good, especially for the Canadian and the North American games. But, of course, the conversation, what's really hovering around all this, is what's going to happen in 2018 with the Olympics. Have there been conversations? Have there been chats over a coffee, over a late night soda, over what kind of over what the thoughts are of the players? Do they want to go there? Do they want to go to South Korea? Do they want to be part of it? What have you heard? What's being discussed out there?
To be honest, I haven't been in that situation when I was talking to players about it, but only just read articles like you guys and whatever Ovi said and maybe a couple other guys said. It makes sense. I mean, for players, take a pride and play for their own country because just the way things are. And I don't know, I wish I could tell you more about it, but if I look at our team, not pretty much all the players from our team can go to Olympics. Some of them didn't make to a qualifying tournament, so it just it's probably wouldn't be a good discussion to bring it up, whereas all the different countries and different players sitting on it and how exciting or not exciting to go to Olympics. So, I mean, it's hard, but as a player, if I look at myself, I want to be there. I want to play for my country because when I play in 96 and, 2006 and 98, I believe, Nagano. Yeah, mm-hmm. So that was a lot of fun for me. And be a part of a special event like that, this is just creates memory for the rest of your life.
I'm curious, earlier in the interview you talked about you weren't sure where this would go. Wouldn't it be wise to keep a level of Team Europe at the? We know there's going to be another World Cup. This has been enough of a success that the players and the league will get together to create another. Wouldn't it make sense that Team Europe every 4 years becomes almost a fact of life?
Well, yes, I mean, but for us, like we, I remember when we met first a time ago, all our coaches and staff, and that was almost like a year ago. And our discussions was just the first off the bat, how are we going to find out our identity as a group and how the coach is going to sell up to a player, make sure they are ready for the tournament. That was just the key to get everybody on the same page. And for us, I was looking at our rosters, potential roster at that time, and then the leadership what he had, like Chara, Hossa, Anze Kopitar, and others. I mean, I know then we have a good group, and there shouldn't be a problem for us to get together as a group. And 4 years from now, I'm not sure what the NHL is going to decide, but it will be nice. I think for any of the players, like because if there is no Team Europe, we wouldn't be see Anze Kopitar or Bellemare or a few other guys, which is they deserve to be on that kind of in a tournament like that, especially a special like that tournament, like a World Cup of Hockey.
Peter, we appreciate this. Best of luck in the preparations. We will be watching, of course. And congratulations on reaching it this far in the World Cup of Hockey.
Thank you, Arash and John. And I was promoted to assistant GM, so thank you.
Assistant,
hey,
right.
The race, the big time.
There you go.
Even on this phone call.
Yeah.
Things happen fast.
Thank you, guys.
All right, Peter. Good luck tomorrow, man.
Peter, we'll see you down there.
Thank you.
Peter Bunder, the assistant GM.
There you go.
Team Europe.
You know, and the other thing to remember is that the international stage, when you see somebody like Zdeno Chara with the potential of not going to South Korea for the Olympics of Rash, this will probably be his last international challenge.
Right.
His last performance on this stage. 4 years a long time for a guy his age in the NHL and in the World Cup. So I tell you what, being around them for the last couple of days, that group, it has been really special. They have created something there that not many can measure. Very similar to what the 23 and under team did.
10 years ago, just over 10 years ago, yep. July 1st, 2006, Zdeno Chara was the most sought-after free agent to hit the open market. The big defenseman left Ottawa. Mm-hmm. Pete Chiarelli was the assistant GM, signed him in Boston, 7 years, $49 million, which at the time was just massive money. And 10 years later, and everything he's been through health-wise with that body, for Zdeno Chara to still be playing at an elite international level speaks volumes. He's not what he once was. But at some point, as he retires here, think about what this man has accomplished, including a Stanley Cup ring.
Well, I think he's a Hall of Famer. I think Zdeno Chara is a Hall of Famer. He'll have, I don't have a vote. I'm not one of the 17 special people. But I'd put Zdeno Chara in the Hall of Fame. And, by the way, a great humanitarian. He's done a great many things off the ice in the Boston area and in Europe to support underprivileged people.
Team Europe, Team Canada, the World Cup of Hockey Finals, the first country to win two. It's a best two out of three. Canada knocked off Team Europe in the prelims by a 4-1 score. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to chat with our good friend Dave Perkins. And it's going to be a great conversation. We hope you'll stick around to join us, because Perk has been there, done that, seen it all. He's sipped and smoked and enjoyed stogies with some of the all-timers all across the sporting world.
Probably had an Arnold Palmer with Arnold Palmer.
And he did have a beverage and a lunch with Arnold Palmer. And we're going to talk about that conversation and the legacy of Arnold Palmer and just where he ranks in the sporting stratosphere when we return on Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Now, prime time is anytime. Subscribe to the Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now more of the best sports talk on the planet on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Five minutes before the top of the hour, this is Primetime Sports. Arash Madani in for Bob McCowan. Bob's got the sniffles. Hopefully he'll be back in a couple of days. Damian Cox,
you're
also
making it sound like he's not here tomorrow already.
Well, you never know. He sat out today, he might sit out tomorrow.
But we haven't really talked. I know with Jonah we talked about the Jays a little bit, but we haven't talked about the end of this series against the Yankees.
Yeah.
Tonight, Jay Happ again. 20-game winner, Jay Happ for the Jays.
Happ gets the ball. ERA under 330. Unbelievable. What a season he's had. The news of the day is that Osuna and Benoit will be unavailable. They need a bit of a break. So if it goes into a save situation into the ninth, it's Jason Grilly
all the way, huh?
Who may get the ball in that scenario. So the Blue Jays and the Yankees coming up at the top of the hour on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
How frustrating is it for the Jays? They win three games in a row. And if you were hoping to make the Red Sox series at the end of the year at Fenway relevant for a Red Sox-Jays situation.
Well, Boston won 11 in a row, that's all.
Yeah, I know. I mean, 11 in a row. My goodness gracious. Talk about being hot at the right time.
Yeah. Luis Severino goes for the Yankees tonight. The sports world was really rattled. Yesterday, it was shocked. It was in a state of mourning. Jose Fernandez, you know, we woke up to that news mm-hmm. in the morning. The Canadian Football League also had one of its own go down, and then Arnold Palmer. And our friend Dave Perkins joins us, who penned a column for the Toronto Star today. Perk, you had a chance to sit down with Arnold Palmer not that long ago. What? Tell us about that conversation.
Well, I used to go to Bay Hill virtually every year. I really enjoyed that tournament. And maybe 15 years ago, now we're going back. If you remember, the Bay Hill used to be the week before the Players, before they moved the Players to May.
Sure. Okay.
So I used to really like the Bay Hill tournament. I liked being there, and I liked sitting in on Arnold's annual State of the Union press conference and that kind of thing. So one year I said, geez, after the Players next week, I'm going to come back and play this. Just could take a day off and play it. So I went up and covered the Players and went back to Orlando. And I had a 1 o'clock tee time or something, so I got there about 11:30. And I said, I'll hit some balls, but I better get something to eat. So I go out to the practice range, and they got a little snack bar there. And who's sitting there all by himself? The only guy there is Arnold Palmer. And Arnold looks at me and says, what the hell are you doing back here? And I said, well, I always wanted to play your golf course and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, Arnold immediately tried to talk me into the $100 a man money game that they play
sure.
every day. But I wasn't up for that. But anyway, Arnold says, well, grab a bite and we'll just, we'll have it. So we sat there just shooting the breeze for about 20 minutes about stuff. And, Arnold had a real soft spot for Canada and Toronto. His first professional win was the 1955 Canadian Open at Weston, as you know. Mm-hmm. And Arnold knew a lot of people up here. And, Arnold was just a real good guy to hang out with. Arnold liked jokes. Arnold had a good sense of humor. And we just sat there and had a real nice time. He drank an Arnold Palmer, that half iced tea, half lemonade thing that he has trademarked, actually.
Yeah.
Made about $100 million selling while we're up. We just sat and yacked, and then Arnold says, well, let's hit some balls. And I said, okay, you hit him here, and I'll go down there,
Right.
I just didn't want to be around, with my swing next to him. Arnold could still knock it out there pretty good. He was probably just turned 70 or so, and he could still hit it pretty good then.
You know what's interesting about this? I mean, we had a caller, Bob, in the 4 o'clock hour. I believe it was Mike from Sarnia, who not only recalled being in Montreal for the Canadian Open in 67, but he was talking about the sixth hole and that it was 440 yards. And he remembered that Palmer drove it through the fairway into the rough. And he remembered the approach shot. He said, I can just picture it like yesterday. And with athletes, with there's certain athletes, people remember the most intense detail. The way they may remember the first time they watched Michael Jordan live or the first time they saw Usain Bolt run.
Sure.
And Arnold Palmer was one of those. One of those athletes, one of those icons. Somebody that that was a little different than everybody else.
Yeah, it's just that it's that unknowable word, charisma, right? No one, can really define it, but you know it when you see it. It's like Hollywood star quality. You don't know what it is, but you know it when you see it.
Mm.
And Arnold certainly had it. He was a groundbreaking guy. I mean, women loved him. I mean, Arnold had a terrific reputation as a great ladies' man, as we all know. And that was part of who he was. He was a groundbreaker in so many ways in golf. He was the first television athlete, mm-hmm. First pro athlete who was a real great TV star. I would say Mickey Mantle would have been that, except that, the Yankees only made the World Series. That was only 1 week a year. And Palmer, even then, the Masters was a big deal. The U.S. Open was a big deal. He made the British Open a big deal by going over and playing in it and recommending that his fellow American stars did the same thing and treat it like it's the world championship that it is. So Arnold had a lot more TV exposure back then, and he was gripping and ripping when we didn't know what that meant.
And I mean, as great a golfer as he was, Dave, he was a bigger brand.
Yeah, no question. And Mark McCormack was, you know, he was responsible for that. He was the father of modern agentry, if we will. And Arnold was the perfect client because Arnold was so personable. And, you know, he looked people in the eye, he shook their hands, he signed, you know, millions and millions of autographs. As I tried to make the point today, you know, the three icons we've lost this year, guys that'd be on anybody's Mount Rushmore of sports, are Muhammad Ali, Gordie Howe, and Arnold Palmer. All of them just signed autographs, you know, for generations of people. That was their way. They were good with people. Ali obviously had some afflictions, and you know, Gordy had trouble at the end, but they were all good with people too.
And you brought it up in the article, and it's something that the previous generation did so well, is not only did they sign the autographs, you could actually read their names.
You could read it. I saw you had Jacobson on a little while ago. And I remember once Peter telling me a story that Peter had a beautiful florid signature himself, and you know, I once said to him, don't you wish your name was Mike Weir or Pete Rose, you know, the little eight letter shots that you could sign in half a second. And he told a story that when he was young, and he would just bang off autographs in a line of people, and Arnold stopped him and said, look, sign your name so that people can read it, so that 10 or 15 years from now they'll look at that and say, yeah, I spent a moment with Peter Jacobson. You know, I think the way Jacobson phrased it was Arnold told him, you're creating memories, so, you know, create good ones. And I that's basically all that Arnold left behind was good memories. You know, there'd be no Golf Channel without Arnold. The senior tour was a direct result of Arnold getting too old to play on the regular tour, and people still wanted to see him. A lot of things happened. I mean, he was the first guy to, the first golfer to get a pilot's license and fly from event to event, and you know, now they all fly around on private jets, as you know, but Arnold took the bull by the horns and got his own pilot's license, and this is all pretty good. And he died worth, you know, $600 or $700 million, which is, that's pretty good for a guy who was, you know, he grew up in a house that didn't have indoor plumbing
and didn't make all that much as a player.
No, the biggest check he ever made, I looked it up, was $50,000.
Wow.
And that was in the last tournament he won in 1973. I think it was the Bob Hope Open, whatever they call it now. But he made 50 grand. But he was the first golfer to make $1 million in purse money. Now, I mean, purse money means nothing now because of the, you know, they used to play for...
You're talking in his career, Perk.
Sure.
Yeah. No, but people say $1 million, and they all think a year. Right. You're talking $1 million in his career.
Somebody won $10 million yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But he made, you know, somebody, I think it was Darren Revelle, estimated he made $350 million in endorsements. So he did all right.
Well, and that's the other part of it. I think the last pro event he won was in Edmonton at the CPGA. Champion at Mayfair.
Yeah.
So he started his career winning in Canada and finished his career winning in Canada.
Right.
But we're talking about a guy that hasn't won a tournament, didn't win a tournament for 42 years.
Correct.
And his staying power was absolutely remarkable.
Yeah. You know, Alistair Johnson, who took over from Mark McCormack when McCormack passed away. I knew Alistair a little bit. I had dinner with him once in Florida. And he said, and that's, once again, this is going back 12, 15 years. Alistair said at that point, Arnold Palmer's average endorsement had been 27 years.
Wow.
In other words, if somebody signed with him, they stayed with him.
It's a lifetime deal.
It was a lifetime deal, basically. And, you know, I would have to say he was worth the money to the endorsers because they kept coming back.
So at some point when Jack Nicklaus's time comes,
right,
and the conversation begins, who had the bigger impact on the game? Is that a conversation?
I don't think so. I think Arnold had the bigger impact. Jack was the better player. And, you know, and they, the two of them have been great friends for the last couple of decades, but they were bitter, bitter rivals.
Yeah, I was going to say they weren't always that way.
Oh, no, they were in each other, you know. Arnold grew up hating Ben Hogan, for one thing. Arnold didn't like Hogan because Hogan had had dumped on him one time when Arnold went to the Masters. And Hogan was kind of a crusty guy, and he got on Arnold's wrong side, or Arnold got on his wrong side. I don't remember the genesis of it. But, you know, Arnold he wasn't just a nice guy. You know, he was a real hard competitor. And when he came up, he was the king in more ways than one. He was the best player. Well, Nicklaus took the best player title away from him, and Arnold didn't want to see it go. You know, there was a stretch where they went back and forth for, I think, 7 consecutive Masters, each one winning, you know, on the off year. And Arnold won, what, 58, 60, 62, 64, and Nicklaus won 61, 3, 5, something like that. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look it up. But I mean, they went back and forth, and it was a real, you know, a real competition between the two of them.
And let's face it, I mean, even to this day, as personable as Jack has become, he was never like Arnold.
No, and Jack was widely disparaged when he was a younger player. You know, he was overweight, and you know, they called him Fat Jack in the headlines. You know, which it seems kind of cruel, but he, you know, Arnold was a swashbuckling guy that everybody loved and everybody wanted to be, and you know, and Jack was this young, staid guy who just hit the ball tremendous distances. He was a little bit more of a machine, and Arnold was a bit more of a pirate out there.
And as you said, and I think this is really the key in so many ways, Arnold and television.
Sure.
Arnold and television, it was a match made in heaven.
Right, absolutely. I mean, all of a sudden Arnold was in everybody's living room every couple of weeks on TV, and people liked what they saw.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and I mean, it wasn't like, you know, football was just coming onto TV then. Well, the players wore helmets and great big pads. Nobody knew who they were, and ball players were, you know, pretty far away. There was no such thing as a close-up. And, you know, it was basically once a week for them, too.
Right.
Well, Dave, we appreciate this. I mean, it's a great column that you've penned in the Toronto Star about.
Well, that's a jet lag column, because I woke up yesterday in Italy and flew back.
Oh.
And I was up this morning out it came. So there you go.
Hey, how's the book going?
I don't know. It, amazingly enough, in Italy for 2 weeks, not one person asked me about.
No kidding. Well, if you're watching on television, you see it now. Fun and Games, My 40 Years Running Sports by Dave Perkins. The foreword is by Brian Williams. It's a great read. We recommend you
And the best news is Arash and I aren't in it. That's a good thing.
But there's a couple of Arnold stories that are in it. So there
good.
You go.
Good.
Terrific. Perk, always good, man. We appreciate the time.
Okay.
All right, Dave Perkins. Again, the author of Fun and Games, My 40 Years Running Sports. It's actually a terrific, terrific read. Blue Jays and the Yankees. Final game of the series goes tonight at Rogers Center. Mike Wilner, Jerry Howarth, Joe Siddle will have the call coming up at the top of the hour. If you missed it earlier, Osuna and Benoit not available to the Blue Jays tonight. Jason Grilley would likely get the ball in the ninth. Jay Happ gets the start this evening. This show will be at the Rogers Center tomorrow for the entire Orioles series. We'll be at the ballpark, and hopefully Bob and Damien will be back soon.
And down the street, starting tomorrow night, the World Cup of Hockey final, and Mike Babcock has said it's the same lineup, so Ryan Getzlaff, who had an off day today, a maintenance day early in the season for a player.
September.
I know. Anyway, so he's going with the same lineup. That means Weber's in, Getzlaff's in, and Carey Price is in goal against his old goaltending partner, Yaroslav Halak from the Montreal Canadiens when they played back in 2010, now have gone their separate ways.
Canada facing Team Europe in the World Cup of Hockey. We thank their assistant general manager, Peter Bondra, who joined us earlier. Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Dave Perkins, who you just heard. Peter Jacobson reflecting on the life and times of Arnold Palmer, Jonah Carey of CBS Sports. For John Shannon, I'm Arash Madani. The Blue Jays and the Yankees coming up at 7 o'clock. We will be at Rogers Center tomorrow, Wednesday and Thursday, when the Orioles come to town, the ultimate showdown for that wild card spot. This has been Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks. We will see and speak with you tomorrow. Good night, everybody.